Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. A person who called a little while ago asked about a call I had yesterday, I think it was yesterday, about will animals go to heaven? Will pets go to heaven? So I just want to draw your attention to the fact that we have a, if you didn't hear it, you can hear it this way, but we have an audio of that call, and really the whole call, including my comments about it, is now available on Twitter. So I retweeted it. So if you follow me on Twitter, my address there is at Patrick Madrid. You'll see it there. And this is, I haven't had a chance to watch this, but this is actually a video, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
is that right?
It's an audio video. So it's really audio, but to be on YouTube, you have to have an image.
Right.
So I've got a little image of a dog with a halo. I was wondering if you were going to poo-poo that. Like,
well, when I saw it, I thought, I know why Cyrus did that, because that adds intrigue. Can a dog have a halo? You know?
Right. And the first image I had was of a lady holding a collar, and it was, you know, an empty collar, and it was just,
a dog collar.
It was just too sad. Mm-hmm. But I have an email. We have an email about that call from yesterday. It was really good.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is, I don't know if this is the guy's real name or not, but he calls himself Moondog. And
okay.
He says, the ladies call in about her dead dog, and you turned a shapely thesis right in front of our eyes or ears with continuous regard for the woman's distress. I have heard this topic come up before on Catholic radio, and it's usually a rip the clotted bandage off approach of cold-blooded theology. But you brought...
Well, he has a way with words, doesn't he?
This guy is definitely a writer.
He's a wordsmith.
You brought us a unique consolation using Jesus' promise that all wounds will be healed and all sorrows consoled, and that God only does the best, a thought new to my usually grumbly worldview. Then you gave a very cogent explanation of what the theology might mean, with the understanding the final answer to life's persistent questions will wait for final days. Although this question will undoubtedly be brought to you again, I can only hope that you have the patience and energy to bring all the well-made thought you brought to us today. So
that's really nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. So he's like, that's why they pay you the big bucks. and this is a nice part. Your concern for the lady's feelings for her beloved dog proves Christianity is a way. I think it should be the way.
The way, yeah.
A new way of dealing with a fallen world.
That's really nice of him. And what was the name again? I know the nickname, but was there an actual
Moondog.
Name?
Moondog. That's all I have.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, wow. Thank you. I appreciate that. And maybe to that point, that's a great reason why we have this resource now. If maybe your kids ask you about, well, will Fluffy go to heaven? And maybe you yourself are wondering about that. If you go over to the show Twitter feed or my Twitter feed, mine is at Patrick Madrid. Or go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can access it there as well.
I just retweeted it, so it'll be at the top. So it'll be very,
okay,
very
good.
Easy to find.
Good. And that is the dog with the halo.
That's right.
Good. Yeah, that would be worth sharing. And my advice would be, especially if this is a topic that may have come up in your circle of friends on Facebook, for example, feel free to grab the link to that, and you can pop it out there wherever you want. Share it, text it to your people, and maybe somebody's going through that very situation right now, this may be consoling to them. So it's there for you. Thanks, Cyrus. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, you'll like this. Teresa just wrote in from Minneapolis. She's listening on our 1330 AM station. And the subject line is, not offended. Good morning, you two, she says. No, I'm not offended, being a Minnesotan. We have much more to be offended about in Minnesota these days. Like the crazy left just took control of the state, and first on their agenda is abortion up to birth. Now that offends me. I'm right there with you on that one, Teresa, for sure. She says, I met you, Patrick, when you were here. I was one of those nice people, Teresa. Well, I can tell that you are. I like all the Minnesotans I've met. Of course, I haven't met the crazy leftist politicians. They probably wouldn't deign to meet with somebody like me. But I can understand why that would really bug you. I mean, being a native Californian myself, although I live in Ohio now, I cringe when I see what the great state of California has become politically. It's just, yeah, I share your view. I feel your pain, as somebody once said. Thank you for that. Let's see. Oh, yeah, we have another one. This one just came in, too. This is from Jordan, listening in Minneapolis on the same station. And he said in the subject line, Minnesota. He said, Patrick, nah, we're not offended by Minnesota. That might just be because we don't have anything, that we don't have any getting offended bones in our bodies, though. But he says, if you're looking to educate yourself on how Minnesotans and Wisconsinians speak, I'd recommend looking up Charlie Behrens on YouTube. I wouldn't blame you if you're not looking to educate yourself on the topic, though. See you later. Yours in Christ, Jordan. So, yeah. Thank you, Jordan. I would like to be able to pass if I were on the streets in any town, Wisconsin, or any town, Minnesota, and sound like the natives. I just might read that book. Cyrus, though, you've lived in Wisconsin for years, so you're probably really good.
Yeah, and it's
really
Wisconsinites. I'm not sure what.
Not Wisconsinians?
No, Wisconsinites. That's how we refer to ourselves. Mm. But I'm not native, so good to know. Maybe they tricked me. I don't know.
Good to know. You're originally from Oregon, right? Let's go to Marie now, just outside Chicago. Hi, Marie.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Patrick. I was calling. I had a question. I just was listening to you earlier, and you were talking to the woman, and she asked about not baptized and marrying Catholic. I have a question. My daughter is dating somebody. They're both in their mid-20s. And he was raised in nothing, basically, and is not baptized. Okay. And he sees no reason to be baptized. My daughter went to all Catholic schools and the whole thing, but she has fallen away from her faith, too. But I always thought she'd get married in the Catholic Church, and now I'm wondering. I looked it up. I thought you could get a dispensation to marry a non-Catholic in the mm-hmm. church and still have a wedding in the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a provision for that. So there are various terms for different scenarios. Disparity of cult, for example. If she's marrying somebody who's not baptized and has no interest in being baptized, there obviously can't be a sacramental wedding. There can be a valid marriage, but it couldn't be sacramental because both parties have to be baptized for that to take place. So it would require a dispensation from the bishop for her to get married to a non-Catholic, a non-baptized party, excuse me. And I don't know how common it is anymore for people to have the awareness that they should petition for that kind of a dispensation, but it can be done. Canon law provides for it. I don't recommend it because it's setting themselves up for the likelihood of a very difficult marriage unless she's going to just completely collapse and not practice her faith, which would be a real tragedy. And I know you know that. But if she wants to maintain her Catholic faith, this is kind of built-in difficulty from the very get-go. If she and her husband can't even agree on who God is and how to worship God. And so if this is inevitable and they're going to get married, I would indeed encourage her to contact the bishop. Now, she can do that through her parish priest if she's willing to do that. But that way, then it gets to the heart of the issue of her having a valid marriage, valid in the eyes of the church. So there's just some requirements, and the church asks Catholics who are getting married to follow those rules. And in the case of the canon law pertaining to marriage, that dictates whether or not the marriage would be deemed valid. So it's a big deal.
But I'm sorry, but you said it wouldn't be sacramental because he's not baptized, and as of right now, sees no reason to be.
Right, yeah, it wouldn't be sacramental. So you can have a valid marriage, valid in the eyes of the church. I mean, two atheists getting married at the Justice of the Peace, presuming that they're eligible to get married, and one is a man and one is a woman, and there's nothing preventing them from getting married. The church recognizes that as a valid marriage. You can have a Hindu and a Muslim, or a Hindu and a Buddhist, or an atheist and a Buddhist get married in front of the Justice of the Peace, or married by a captain on a ship or something like that, and the church says, all other things being equal, that's a valid marriage. Now, obviously, they're not sacramental marriages. But in the case of a Catholic, if one or the other or both of the parties is Catholic, that's where the difficulty comes in, because a Catholic has an obligation to get married in the church and for the marriage to be witnessed and blessed by a priest, or could be a deacon or a bishop. And so if the Catholic doesn't do that and doesn't receive a dispensation, then the marriage is objectively invalid. That doesn't apply to anyone else. It's something that Catholics are bound by, and that's what makes it very painful for families, where the Catholic son or daughter just says, to heck with that, I'm not doing that, why should I do that? And it creates all kinds of problems and hurt and division. It's really sad. I hope that doesn't happen with you.
But so if it's not sacramental, then they don't have the blessing, is that the word to use, with the marriage?
They would receive a blessing. So let's say that she said, okay, we'll get married at the Catholic Church, Mom, and Father McGillicuddy, or Father Miguel Cuddy, either one, can officiate at the wedding. It wouldn't be a mass. There would be just a wedding ceremony, and it wouldn't be sacramental. Because in order for there to be a sacrament, because each of the spouses confers the sacrament on each other, if one of them is not baptized, he can't confer the sacrament on her. And since he's not baptized, she can't confer the sacrament on him. So they would be, all other things being equal, validly married, but not, there would be no sacramental dimension to that marriage. If he were baptized, then there would be. But baptism is essential for that element, for that dimension of marriage.
Well, I guess I used the wrong word then. Sorry. I thought okay. The sacrament conferred graces on the marriage. So then
it
they
does.
Wouldn't have the graces.
No, they would not.
Sacramental. That's more my question than
okay.
Blessings.
Yeah. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but no, there would be no sacramental graces. It doesn't mean that God would not look after them and bless them and protect them and guide them. I mean, he does that for everybody. But he does it in a particular way through the sacraments, but that would not be present in this situation.
Okay, I guess I'll be pulling a St. Monica.
Yeah, yeah. My heart goes out to you. And you know what I would recommend
is
if it's at all possible for him to see his way clear, you know, I mean, obviously you don't want somebody to say, all right, I'll get baptized and not mean it. You don't want that. Or I'll get baptized for you. I don't really believe in God, but if that'll make you happy, I'll do that. You don't want that either, because, you know, somebody has to come to Jesus for real. But maybe over time he would be willing to do that. It's happened before.
Yeah, that's why I think I need to pray a lot, because they're at the age where they don't really listen to me. So,
yeah, I know that. I know the feeling you're going through right now.
Yeah. So, all right, thank you. Thank you for the information.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Marie. Thank you. I recognize these are difficult situations, to be sure. Let's go to Ann now in Prescott Valley, Arizona. Hello, Ann. I bet it's beautiful there in Prescott Valley today, isn't it?
The sun is shining and it's 32 degrees. I'm in northern Arizona, so we do have a little coolness. God bless you all at Relevant Radio. You and Cyrus do a great job.
Thank you.
I have a three-part question, Patrick. The first part is, I currently have the Great Adventure Catholic Bible, the revised second version, second Catholic edition, Revised Standard Version, and I'm wondering if that is the best Bible to have, or do you have another recommendation?
So the Great Adventure Bible is a Revised Standard Version Catholic Edition. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, the RSVCE, as it goes for short, is a good Bible. And it's one that I use. So I mean, you really can't go wrong with that. It's not the same. It's not the same as the New American Bible, which is the Bible version that Catholics are familiar with because they hear the New American Bible version read at Mass. So all the readings at Mass are from that. So it's not going to have exactly the same phraseology in many cases, but it's, I think, in many ways superior to the New American Bible. Plus, it doesn't have all those pesky, problematic notes that the New American Bible is ridden with. So that's another thing. You won't have to wade through some of the stuff that's questionable and problematic in the notes. You can just read the text. And it has, now you're talking about the Bible, the Great Adventure. So they have their own notes in that version. But the translation itself is quite good, if that's what you're asking.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. The second part is a number of my Catholic friends and I have been reading the book Jesus Calling by Sarah Young. Mm-hmm. And earlier this week, I think it was, you had mentioned books by people from other faiths. And I read the back, and the author is Presbyterian. And I'm just wondering, we're wondering if we should be reading this book.
I wouldn't.
Familiar with it?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I mean, I've never read it, but I've heard a number of people ask about this over the years. Since I haven't read it, I'm not going to poo-poo it or anything like that. But what I would say is, when you take stock of something like this and you realize this is a book that is written by, in this case, an evangelical Protestant, there's likely going to be some things in there that are incorrect. It's not guaranteed, but I would, if I were going to read a book like that, I would read it with a real careful approach to make sure that in the middle of all the nice warm fuzzies, because that's what the book's about. It's about what does the Bible say in the warm fuzzy department about how Jesus loves you and he'll comfort you and how can you get encouraging and how to know that God loves you. I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of those things. And quoting scripture, of course, is really good, but since I haven't read the book, I don't know to what extent she extrapolates on those Bible verses with her own thoughts about it. And that's what I'm saying. I don't want to poo-poo the book because I've never read it. It wouldn't be fair of me to do that. But if I were to read something like that, I'd have my radar up to make sure that something erroneous didn't slip through. And that's why I said a minute ago, I wouldn't do it for this reason that I typically just don't read books by, you know, Protestant influencers. I just don't, because there's so many more by Catholics that I know I'm not going to have to worry about the possibility of some problem. So that's more a matter of you are what you eat. And if you're in the habit of feeding on things that are not Catholic and maybe have some admixture of things that are not true, and you may not really realize it. I mean, I've met many people who are very sincere, wonderful people who have been Protestantized in their thinking without even really realizing it because of the radio programs they listen to or the books that they read or the Bible study that they go to. And they're not doing anything intentionally wrong. They're not trying to do anything wrong, but they don't realize that over time you are what you eat. And if you have a steady diet, I don't mean you, but if you have a steady diet of something that that contains something that's not good for you, well, it'll take its toll over time. So I just try to avoid it for that reason. It doesn't mean that I read books by Protestants, I read books by Jews, I read books by Mormons. I mean, I'm not opposed to it when it's necessary, but if it's not necessary, I would skip it personally.
Okay, thank you. And then your take on the Angel Studios production of The Chosen.
Did you say, what is my take on that?
Yes. I mean, is that something we should be watching or not watching?
Well, I've seen one episode, and I thought it was a fine episode. I enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting the way they recontextualize, like the apostles, not the way they're typically depicted in movies and things. So it's certainly an interesting way to go about it. I have no complaints about it. I only saw one episode, though. But I will say that all of the Catholic folk I know, family members, friends, and others who have seen it, love it. They love it. And they're, you know, in some cases, gaga about The Chosen. So who am I to, you know, to gainsay what they're saying, especially since I've only seen the one episode. But my impression, anecdotally, from all the people I've talked to is it's really impactful for them, which is good. Well, hey, we did three questions in a row, and that's pretty good. I hope you stay warm and well-fed today up there in the cold country of northern Arizona. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. You know, we receive over a million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Wait for it. Nah, I was expecting the rug to be pulled out from under me.
Oh, thanks for the idea.
Now I'm always worried about every song.
You got you looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, perfect. I do. By the way, Jeff Lynne, genius. Paul McCartney-level genius. He's like a one-man Beatles, if you ask me.
That's might be the greatest compliment I've ever heard you give anyone.
Well, I mean it. Jeff Lynne, hey, everybody. I mean, you probably, if you're old enough, the song rings a bell, ELO, a lot of great music, but unbelievable songwriter, musician, arranger. I mean, he did it all. When the Beatles, Paul, George, and Ringo went into the studio to do Big Love and, Free as a Bird and Real Love, those cassettes that were left behind by the late John Lennon, he did like a little scratch track on cassette. And so
we were four guys. We were just a band who made it very, very big. That's all.
And so they went into the studio to create those songs as the Beatles with John's voice on the cassette tape. And they tapped Jeff Lynne, whose voice you just heard from ELO, and he produced the whole thing. Just phenomenal. So young people, you know, listen to me now and believe me later, but you would do well to become acquainted with the music of Jeff Lynne. It's really spectacular. And also Traveling Wilburys. I mean, the list goes on. Pretty impressive. Now, that's interesting because I have an email that came in. Where did it go? It just came in. This is from Phil. I haven't really read it all the way through, so I'm going to read it cold. But the subject line caught my eye. Bill Cosby versus Beatles, double standard? That caught my eye. So here's what, and by the way, where is he? Phil is in Wausau, Wisconsin. So he says, I know you get a billion emails. I was hoping that the subject line might catch your eye. And so it did, sir. It did indeed. I really don't care about Bill Cosby or the Beatles, but would not going to Bill Cosby's new comedy tour, assuming the content is clean, based on his personal failings, but at the same time listening to the Beatles music or almost any other rock band for that matter, in spite of their personal failings, constitute a double standard. More importantly, I have a real question. What authority does a bishop or pope have? And he gets into a liturgical question. So I'll come back to that. So yes, you did catch my eye. So let's do this thing. I see the point you're making. Would it be a double standard to go to Bill Cosby's comedy show? He announced the other day that he's going to go on the road and he's going to do comedy for whoever wants to come out and see it. And I expressed my distaste for this, not so much because I was thinking I would go see it. I mean, I don't plan to go see his comedy show. I presume most people would feel the same way. It's basically because of the chutzpah, the hubris of somebody like him, like he, with the things that are known about, you know, what he did, to say, you know, I'm going to go out on the comedy circuit and talk about life and marriage and stuff like that. It just seems really inappropriate to me. So I would differentiate that between knowing that John Lennon and Paul McCartney and I guess the other two guys as well, they smoked dope and they probably were, I mean, not probably, they were all very promiscuous and who knows what kind of stuff they got into, but they didn't go on tour or make albums trying to promote that. They just made music. And so I think maybe as St. Paul says, test all things, hold fast to that which is good. So in the case of the music, I hold fast to that because it is good. Now, there are a couple Beatles songs that I don't listen to. One is the Ballad of John and Yoko because it's blasphemous. And so I don't listen to it. And in the past, when I did listen to it, I felt guilty because, you know, why am I enjoying this song when it's blasphemous against Jesus? So I just stopped listening to it. So there's an example of where I test all things, hold fast to that, which is good. And that's not one of the things that I hold fast to. So I hope these thoughts off the cuff make sense. I hadn't really thought about that before, but I think mainly the Bill Cosby going out on the road after everything that's happened thus far, it just seems like, are you crazy? You know, why would you think people would be interested? Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he'll have sellout concerts. I don't know. I really don't care in the case of Bill Cosby. I wish him well. I hope he gets to heaven. But anyway, I'll leave it at that. So back to your email. He says, your real question is, what authority does a pope or bishop have to control the form or rite of liturgy in their diocese or for the pope in the Church Universal? Pope Benedict had said something to the effect that the traditional Latin Mass was valid and as such could not be abrogated. Does that mean that a priest could or should continue to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass in a diocese where the bishop has shut it down? Well, first, the bishop is the competent authority in his diocese, his territory that he oversees, to make liturgical decisions. So from the standpoint of the church's law, not to mention the theology of holy orders and the episcopacy being the height of holy orders, the fullness of holy orders, he does have the right to govern. He has indeed the obligation to govern. Now, we can acknowledge that and should acknowledge that. And if you're the priest and your bishop has said you're not allowed to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass, as much as I love the traditional Latin Mass, if I were that priest, I would say, I would remonstrate with him and make my case, and here's why I think I should be able to do this. But if the bishop said no, I would be obedient. You have to be obedient to the bishop. You have to be obedient to the pope. Now, the reason it's not the reason I say that, but as I say that, there's another thing to remember, and that is just because from the standpoint of the church's law and the theology of the priesthood, and in particular, the theology of what it means to be a bishop and the authority that is invested in that role, it doesn't mean that any given bishop, or for that matter, any given pope, will exercise that authority wisely. There have been, over the last 2,000 years of the church, popes, bishops certainly, who have unwisely, even harmfully, exercised their authority. Now, we have to keep both truths together in their intention, obviously, but we see the truth. Number one, the bishop does have this authority, and that's objectively true, and we are objectively obliged to be obedient to our bishops in everything but sin. I mean, so if the bishop tells you to go out and commit adultery, you don't have to listen to that. He has no authority to tell you to do something that's sinful. But in those areas where he does have lawful authority, yes, if you're the priest, you must be obedient to your bishop. And ultimately, these bishops, all bishops for that matter, all of us for that matter, will eventually have to render an account of our own lives to the Lord. So it's not as though if a bishop is tyrannical or negligent or doing something else that is inconsistent with his office, it doesn't mean that he gets away scot-free. Eventually, he's going to have to answer to Jesus for that and may well be punished for that. So I think what we have to do as lay people is be obedient to our lawful superiors, be honest. You know, if you're the priest, when you were ordained, you made a solemn promise to your bishop that you would be obedient to him. And that means something. And so assuming that the bishop is not telling the priest to do something sinful, and he says, even though the priest feels that this is wrong, and even though it may indeed be wrong, whatever it is, if the bishop who has the right to do this says, we're not going to do this here, we're going to do it this way, the priest should be obedient. And I know it can be very galling, and people can get very infuriated at the thought of a persecuted priest, but I can't help but think of a priest like St. Padre Pio, who is a wonder worker. He had the stigmata. He could read your soul. If you went to him for confession and you left something out, he would tell you what it was. He never saw you before. You could have come from the furthest ends of the earth and showed up in his confessional, and if you intentionally left out some serious sin, he would tell you what it was. So he had a magnificent ability to guide souls. He was a miracle worker in so many respects. And his religious superiors at one point said, shut up and sit down. And he shut up and he sat down. He was in the right. They were in the wrong. He was unjustly persecuted. He was canceled, to coin a phrase, by his religious superiors. And he didn't fight against that. He didn't set up a GoFundMe account. He didn't, you know, whip his followers into a frenzy. He didn't do any of those things. He just said, okay. And he shut up and he sat down. And then eventually he was exonerated. And eventually he came back full force when he had permission to do so. So my point here is I look at him as a paradigm of this kind of a situation and say, well, Padre Pio, head and shoulders above in terms of, you know, like, palpable holiness and working miracles and bilocating and healing people and reading of souls and bringing countless people back to Jesus through the sacraments, etc. And so head and shoulders, no disrespect to any priests or bishops out there, but I would say he was sort of head and shoulders above everyone else in that regard. And if even he was willing to shut up and sit down because his lawful superiors told him to do so, I think we should take a cue from him. And humility and obedience, in my view at least, and I'll leave it at this, humility and obedience is a sign of the true character of a priest who is being persecuted. It tells you something really important about his character. And even though there are unjust persecutions of priests, we see that, we know that, that happens. Even though there are bishops who might be tyrannical or they might be capricious, those things happen too. The priest has made a promise, and this is where the rubber meets the road. Are you going to live up to your promise or are you not going to live up to your promise? And which way you go says a lot about your character. I'll leave it at that. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Hugh now. I'm sorry, Hui, in Long Beach. Good morning, Hui.
Good morning, Patrick. Yes, actually, it's pronounced Hugh.
Right? Hugh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. First time caller, long time listener. I just have a quick question, follow up question to your earlier callers regarding to the marriage. When I got married years ago, my wife at that time was Catholic, and I wasn't. I became a Catholic and got baptized in the church about two years afterwards. Okay. Does that mean my marriage in the church initially was not sacramentally valid?
Can you repeat the circumstances again? I want to make sure I understood the details. So you
when we got tell married me again. Years ago, my wife was a Catholic at that time, and I wasn't. But I became a Catholic and got baptized 2 years after our marriage. Does that mean my marriage in the church at that time was not sacramentally valid at the moment at that time?
Okay, now I understand your question. Thank you for repeating it for me. So at the time, no, it was not sacramental, and we can presume it was valid. So she went to, she got permission, she got a dispensation to marry you. You were not baptized, but you got married in the church. There was a priest, I presume, or a deacon who was, okay. So that part would not have been sacramental, but it was valid. But once you became baptized, then your marriage automatically becomes sacramental. So,
oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know, because I got really worried there when you mentioned to the previous caller that it won't be sacramental. But then my situation is a little bit different from hers. But thank you for answering that question. Can I ask you a second question?
Sure.
Yes. You mentioned before in the past you really liked the Baltimore Catechism. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you recommend that a lot. So I found some audios on YouTube by Father Benedict Hughes. Is that something that you recommend, you highly recommend? Because I've started listening to that. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure it's something that you mentioned. It's the same kind of on the same line.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the audio version, but if it's the Baltimore Catechism, I'm sure it's going to be fine. I'm just not familiar with that one. The one that I champion is the St. Joseph edition. The reason I make this distinction here is because there are any number of other Baltimore catechisms that are out there, and the text is certainly fine. It's the same text from one publisher to another. But what makes the St. Joseph edition unique is the illustrations. And that's what I think is very effective in pedagogy with children, is especially because they're retro pictures from like the 1950s. They're not pictures, they're drawings, but from the 1950s. And it's just very interesting for adults or kids alike. So yes, two thumbs up for any Baltimore catechism, but even more if it's the St. Joseph edition that has the illustrations. That's the one I really like.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. You have a very good day, okay?
Yes, thank you. Now that I have permission, I certainly will. Thank you, Hugh. We'll take a break and we'll come right back. Plenty more to talk about. My number is 888-914-9149. And for your good to know file, people are wondering, what did Pope Benedict really say on his deathbed? Did he say, Jesus, I love you, or Lord, I love you? I have an answer for you when we come back from this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, 888-914-9149. Archbishop George Ganschwein was the prefect of the papal household and the private secretary to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and then when he was Pope Benedict XVI. And there's an interview with Vatican News. We have a link to it, so you can check it out. And it's an interview with Archbishop Ganschwein talking about the final hours, final moments of Pope Benedict's life. And I'll read to you a little bit from it so that you can know, because there's some question like, what did he say on his deathbed? Thousands of faithful, this is a question from the interviewer, thousands of faithful pay their respects to the mortal remains of the Pope Emeritus. You have spent a large part of your life with him. How do you live now? And Archbishop Ganschwein says, humanly, suffering very much. It hurts. I suffer spiritually very well. I know Pope Benedict is now where he wanted to go. Question, how did Benedict XVI live his last days? What were his last words? Ganschwein says, I didn't hear his last words with my own ears, but the night before his death, one of the nurses assisting him overheard them. Around 3 o'clock, he said, Lord, I love you. The nurse told me in the morning, as soon as I arrived in the bedroom, that these were the last truly understandable words that he spoke. Usually, he said, we prayed lauds in front of his bed. That morning, too, I said to the Holy Father, let's do as we did yesterday. I pray aloud and you join in spirit. In fact, it was no longer possible that he could pray aloud. He was really out of breath. There, he only opened his eyes a little He understood the question and nodded his head yes. So I started. At around 8 o'clock, he began to breathe more and more heavily. There were two doctors, Dr. Poliska and a resuscitator, and they told me, we fear that now the moment will come when he will have to fight, when he will have to have his last fight on earth. I called, he was referring to some religious sisters there, and told them to come because he had reached his agony. He was lucid at that time. I had already prepared the accompanying prayers for the dying earlier, and we prayed for about 15 minutes altogether while Benedict XVI breathed more and more heavily. It became clear that he could not breathe well. So I looked at one of the doctors and asked, but did he go into agony? He told me, yes, it started, but we don't know how long it will last. Question, what happened then? He says, we were there. Everyone then prayed in silence, and at 9:34, he took his last breath. Then we continued our prayers, no longer for the dying, but for the dead. And we concluded by singing Alma Redemptoris Mater. He died in the octave of Christmas, his favorite liturgical time, on the day of his predecessor, St. Sylvester, Pope under the Emperor Constantine. He had been elected the day in which a German Pope, St. Leo IX of Alsace, is remembered, and he died on the day of a Roman Pope, St. Sylvester. He said, I told everyone, I'll call Pope Francis right away. He will be the first to know. I called him, and he said, I'll be there immediately. Then, when he arrived, I accompanied him to the bedroom where Pope Benedict had died, and I told everyone, stay. The Pope greeted them. I offered him a chair, and he sat next to the bed, and he prayed. He gave his blessing, and then he left. And then one other question. It's a much longer interview, so I won't read all of it, but which words of his spiritual testament touched you? And he says, the testament as such touched me deeply. Choosing a few words is difficult, but this testament had already been written on the 29th of August, 2006, the liturgical feast of the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist. It was handwritten, and he's referring to Pope Benedict. It was handwritten, very legible, but very small, but legible, in the second year of his pontificate. In German, you would say, O ton Benedikt, that is, this is really Benedict. If I had the text without knowing the author, I would have recognized it. It contains the spirit of Benedict. Reading it and meditating on it, one sees it really is his, and all of him is in there in two pages. And so he describes it as saying, it was basically a thank you letter to God and to his family. So there's more. I would encourage you to read it. Very edifying, to be sure. And so just to clear up the questions that people were asking, did he say, Jesus, I love you, or Lord, I love you? According to the eyewitness, it was Lord, I love you. And that was not when he died, but the evening before, 3 a.m, before the hour of mercy, by the way. So there you have it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Bill now in Pittsburgh. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Patrick. I'm infant baptized in 1957.
Okay.
I left the church in 1970 when I was 13. And I was blind for 40 years. So okay. I'm playing a lot of catch up. And the most recent thing that has me stumped is penal substitution. All mm-hmm. my life, I've understood that Jesus died on the cross for my sin. And so recently I heard Scott Hahn talking about this and says that the Catholic Church teaches it is not penal substitution. And I'm really confused. So I was hoping maybe you could have an explanation for me or even tell mm-hmm. me, like, is there a place in the catechism to go to or a book I could go for?
Yeah. Scott himself has written widely on this topic. So A Father Who Keeps His Promises would be the book I'd refer you to, because it's about the way in which the covenant that God had with his people was fulfilled in Jesus, and how he, as the suffering Messiah, atoned for the sins of the people. Not having heard whatever it was that you heard Scott say, I mean, I know Scott very well, and I've known him for many years, so I trust what he says on these matters, and he's much more deeply knowledgeable about them at a biblical level than I am by far. So you won't go wrong if you delve deeper into what he said. But as far as a book is concerned, I would recommend that one, The Father Who Keeps His Promises. Now, I would also recommend, I want to get the Latin title correct, but this is a This is a, actually it was written by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And that is, the Latin phrase is going to escape me. If I don't think about it, I'll be able to get it. But it's about the uniqueness of Jesus as the Messiah and the Redeemer, and how his death on the cross redeemed us from sin. So there's a, you might say, an element of what's known as penal substitution. For people who hear that, they don't know what that means. It means that Jesus was the substitute for us. He took the penalty for us. It was our sins that he died for. And there, that is true, but it can be distorted in some ways, and often is distorted. And I think the penal substitution term is often associated with Protestant thought on that topic. So I would start with that Scott Hahn book. And as the show unfolds and my brain in the background thinks of the title I just remembered it. Dominus Jesus. So Dominus Jesus, the Lord Jesus, is the document. And this was, under the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI, but it was issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And it is on the unicity and salvific universality of Jesus Christ in the Church. So it's a theological reflection on Jesus as Messiah and Redeemer, and in particular, what is it that he did for us on the cross? So I would say that would be another very, and of course it's a magisterial expression of what Jesus did as our unique Savior. Nobody else could save us save for Jesus. So that would be another resource that you could delve into for greater clarity on that.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And within moments, you can even get your stopwatch out and see how quickly it happens. But Cyrus will get this posted on the show Twitter feed for you, Bill.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. How about Nancy? My absolutely most favorite person in the world is named Nancy. So I already have a liking for you, Nancy in Phoenix. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk to the comment on the caller that called about his marriage being invalid. Mm-hmm. I had that issue when I got married. The priest asked my husband, who was not Catholic, if he had been baptized, and he said, yes. But he hadn't. He had been dedicated. And so then we found out a year, the next Easter when he converted, that he hadn't been baptized. And so he was baptized, but then 26 years later, he was considering the diaconate, and they were like, oh, we hadn't gotten the permission from the bishop. So I just wanted to say that if you're curious or worried, you just contact the diocese where you were married, and they can check. And it's really easy to get it fixed, because we were like, oh no.
To get what
fixed? It had been 26 years. To get because our marriage was, in fact, invalid for 26 years. And so we talked to the diocese. They checked the canon lawyer. They said, yes, indeed, it isn't valid, but by the stroke of the bishop's pen,
there are several different nuances here. One would be a simple convalidation. There's also a radical sanation that can, in other words, you heal the marriage at the roots. There are different terms that are used by the canon lawyers, but you're right. These are things that can be remedied, and I'm glad that you're bringing this up, because there are plenty of people who don't realize that the Church has remedies for difficulties like this.
Yeah, they do, it's not that we had to talk to the annulment coordinator at our church, which was very weird because we were, but we just totally fell through the cracks, and you can't fall through the cracks because we weren't trying to get away with anything. But there are people that are in that situation. Since this happened to me, I've probably found three or four of my people that I know that have been in the same situation. So it's not that hard to fall through the cracks, because a lot of Protestants, when they're dedicated, is something different than being baptized. And a lot of them assume it's the same thing. And that's what happened with my husband. It's definitely not the same thing.
Yeah. So the solution to that, thanks for that, Nancy. I appreciate it very much. I'm glad that there was a happy ending. The solution for that is, if the person finds out, I wasn't baptized, I was just dedicated, just get baptized. So it's a quick solution to that problem. And And so that's what the parish priest would say. Just, okay, fine, we'll get you baptized. Problem solved. Well, thanks, Nancy. Appreciate it. I think we do. We're going to roll the dice on this one. How about Mary in Plainfield, Illinois? Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is, what do you do with relics? I've just acquired two of them. One, mm-hmm. I believe to be a first class, the other to be a third class. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if I am the one who is supposed to actually be the one holding these. They were in some things that my mother had. She's passed 2 years mm-hmm. ago. Mm-hmm. And as I was cleaning things out, I was like, these need to go to the right place. So what is that place, or how do I make it the right place?
You're in luck. Your home is the right place. If you want to keep those relics, you're more than welcome to do so. There's no prohibition on you having those relics. Especially if they were in your family, they can remain in your family, remain in your home. So you don't have to worry about that. Now, if you would prefer, you could donate the relics to your parish, for example. I'm sure they'd be happy to have the relics somewhere in the church that's done, or a convent of sisters nearby. I mean, that would be the alternative to keeping them in your own home. But you are free to do that if you wish.
Oh, wonderful. Good to know. And then if I kept one, what's the proper mm-hmm. use, proper display? Is it required to be displayed?
There is no real requirement. I mean, obviously you want to show honor and respect, reverence for these sacred relics. If you wanted to display them, you could get a reliquary, something that looks similar to a monstrance for the Holy Eucharist, but it's much smaller. Has a base and a glass center of it, so you could place the relic. If it's one of those little round metal containers, you could do that. You could keep it in a drawer. You could put it someplace in a place of honor. But there's no set requirement for what you have to do. Thanks, Mary. I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.